Hi, I'm Naomi Murphy, and this is the Locked Up Living podcast, where we talk with a wide range of people about harsh aspects of institutional life.
We also explore some of the ways to overcome them and to grow and develop. I'm David Jones. So join us every Wednesday morning, 6 o'clock UK time, for a fresh podcast. Welcome to this special edition of the Locked Up Living podcast. Naomi and I decided that we wanted to start doing one of these specials probably about once a month. And we thought we've got so much experience from the over 170 episodes that we've done, plus our own personal experience in the work, particularly those in forensic and mental health settings, that we thought we could probably make something interesting on a wide range of topics. So today we're going to start by talking about body identity dysphoria. So Naomi is going to start.
Yeah, I thought it'd be interesting to talk about body identity dysphoria, which is sometimes known as body integrity identity disorder or xenomelia, which means foreign limb. Because this is actually coming up in the news next week, and it is a really unusual disorder. And what struck me, actually, I was asked to comment on a story, and what really surprised me was that I hadn't seen anything about it in the press previously, and I was wondering why is this the case in terms of this particular court case. There's two. The story that's in coming to court for sentencing on Mark is an individual who's been labelled the eunuch maker by the tabloid press, and this is Marcus Gustafsson.
It's worth remembering, isn't it, that eunuch makers are not a new thing. In fact, eunuchs used to be created to perform in operas.
Of course, yes. Do you know what kind of time period that was at?
Well, it stopped now, actually. I'm not absolutely certain when it stopped. Perhaps I'll dig that out and bring that back.
There's been another story of a Japanese guy, an artist known as Sugiyama, who castrated himself and auctioned off, eating his genitals for dinner to a number of guests. And people have queried whether this was the inspiration for Marius Gustafsson. Marius Gustafsson is a Norwegian who's accused of broadcasting castration footage on a website where he had a number of subscribers, and he appears to have been the ringleader of eight other men who performed extreme body modifications, which included removal of their penises and testicles, and they filmed and uploaded, and subscribers paid to watch these procedures happening. And this website ran for a 6-year period and appears to have brought in around £200,000 between 2016 and 2022.
Yeah, I was just thinking while you're talking, Naomi, that stories like this come round periodically, sometimes because of a killing or a near killing, which is usually attempted to be explained as some core form of sexual activity, which was questionably consensual, and sometimes in the form of performance art. So performance artists who will stand on stage and do various mutilations to their body. So it's not a new phenomenon.
No, and I think that's a good point, but I also think the psychological, I think even when it's done purportedly in the name of art, you know, it is such drastic behaviour that it's hard to see that as being entirely artistically driven. You know, that might be presented as some kind of justification for it, but if you think about chopping off part of your body just for our, there has to be other psychological processes at work, I think. And I think, I don't know if you remember, the there was quite a lot of media attention probably about 20 years ago where people were having their limbs amputated. So body integrity dysphoria, it traditionally involves people wishing to have an arm or a leg amputated. Apparently, most commonly the right leg below the knee for some reason. But there are a small number of people who feel as if a part of their body doesn't belong to them, and there's a desire to have it removed, as if having that arm or leg chopped off will somehow improve their sense of well-being. And it is a mental disorder, but the person isn't psychotic, and I think that's really quite hard to relate to. But typically the person knows the limb belongs to them, they know it's healthy, but something about it just doesn't feel right with it being attached to them.
Yeah, so I was thinking about that in relation to Gustafsson, who had his limb amputated, and he then went on to claim some special benefit. So in other words, through the public purse, they were paying for what he'd done to himself. And I was thinking about that, and I had several reactions. One was that that's not fair, that's cheating the public, that's forcing the public to pay for his, in inverted commas, performance. And then I thought, well, if this is a mental illness, then it's merely paying for the care which he in the end needed. So I think we're always faced with this kind of conundrum.
I think you're right. I think it is a really challenging ethical issue, because certainly the documentary I watched many, many years ago, there were individuals who had laid on train tracks in order to try and have their legs amputated. And so there was the question about whether it's ethical for doctors to remove parts of bodies in cases like this. And of course, it does create a drain on the state. But it's an interesting quandary for doctors, isn't it, in terms of is it right to deliberately create disability when there is an ongoing burden to the state? But I think, doctors have on occasion been willing to perform that surgery because they've been worried about what the drastic measures someone might take if they do that, themselves. I'm just trying to see if I can see the figures for, I did look at the figures for.
So just to put in that castrati were mainly operated on in the 18th century.
Thank you.
On very young boys, under 10.
And we don't know much about people having parts of their body removed generally, do we? Because I think there's only ever been about 400 cases documented, and that's really very much focused on people who've had their arms or legs amputated. And I think people are aware that other people would view them negatively. But I think the fact that Gustafsson had his left leg removed suggests that is part of his picture, that this is part of this disorder, despite some of the more unusual features of the behaviour.
Yeah. Sorry, what were you going to say?
Well, I was just going to say, I think the sort of sexual body identity dysphoria, body integrity dysphoria, does seem to be a subgroup where people want their genitals removed, and that doesn't seem to be focused on in the literature. And yet I have encountered that in forensic settings on more than one occasion. And I suspect that whilst it is rare, I suspect most clinicians have probably come across somebody who was projecting hatred onto their genitals. Is that something you've encountered?
Yes, although mainly involving people poking things down the urethra, which was had equally harmful effects.
Yeah, but kind of as a form of self-harm?
That was more of a self-harm, and I'm not sure there was a huge amount of sexual pleasure gained from it. Freud, of course, talked about polymorphous perversity with regard to little babies. I mean, he argued that in little children, little babies, sexuality and desire wasn't fixed. It floated around. We most readily think of it in terms of the lips and sucking, but equally other parts of the body could be charged with sexual meaning and power.
I'm not sure I necessarily see it as always being about sex. So as when I, you know, when I was thinking back about the various people that I've known of who have, you know, tried to attack or remove their penises, there seem to be two different kinds. And I think the people who have a history of childhood sexual abuse where they feel their bodies betrayed them, so that idea that when people are sexually abused, sometimes their bodies do respond to the touch and by becoming aroused, because that is what our bodies are supposed to do. So people who are abused as boys feeling very betrayed by their penis and angry with it for becoming aroused, so somehow holding their penis responsible for the fact that they were sexually abused, and a wish to get rid of this part of them which they hate because of the problems that they feel it caused for them. But I also come across people who have attacked their penises because they've been sexually aroused to something that's taboo. So that might be an internalised taboo, so, you know, internalised homophobia, so gay men from religious backgrounds who actually are overrepresented in one particular study where they did look at sexual BID. Or they're sexually attracted to something that is illegal. So some men seem to attack their penis because they want to reduce their risk of sexual assault to others, such as children. And I think in this case, Gustafsson, has been convicted of, you know, making and distributing an indecent image of a child. He'd initially hired the man who castrated him as a male escort for sexual services. And another of the men in the group had possessed extreme pornography. So it does suggest that there's something amongst this group of men where actually maybe some of the motivation was about trying to neutralise their sexual risk to others by removing their sex organs.
Well, that's a very interesting way of putting it, isn't it? I mean, I suppose, I don't think dissimilar to what you're saying, I see this in terms of sadism and masochism, and that we're all relationship-seeking animals, and sometimes we form a relationship with a part of ourself which is toxic and punishing, and sometimes that gets projected out onto something else or somebody else or a part of somebody else or a part of one's own body, and then is available for attack. But it's difficult to know without spending much time with some of these people to understand what's really going on, how long-lasting these impulses are, or are they fleeting, followed by regret, or what? It's hard to imagine that there isn't a time when somebody's sitting alone with a sore on their leg stump or their crotch and feeling glad about it.
Well, I think, because we don't wish to do that, it's very, very hard. I think it's a condition that's extremely hard to empathise with. It's very hard to imagine being in that position. But I listened to a podcast with a man who'd had one of his legs amputated below the knee And actually his regret was that he hadn't had it amputated above the knee. That would have been a bigger thing for him. But he was, you know, he was speaking anonymously because of this risk of, you know, the shame of speaking publicly. And he certainly seemed to be talking about having kind of like always wanted to have his leg removed. And in the studies I've read, it does appear that people seem to be quite fascinated by disabled people. Maybe that's fetishized in some ways. In one study, 87% of people with BID were not the people who were trying to remove, who wanted their arms or legs removed, were sexually attracted to amputees. So it is as though something unusual is going on. But you're right, kind of like it's, we read about the crime, and actually it's so disgusting that it's really hard to have a sense of why anyone would want to do that. But I think it is important to remember at some level there is some distress here. This is such drastic behaviour that there must be an underlying distress that's driven people to these kind of actions.
Well, one imagines so. And you say it's disgusting, but of course it isn't disgusting to everybody, because the whole business of disgust is in itself quite complicated. Why are we disgusted by some things and not by others, and why are we disgusted by the mere idea of some things?
You brought up sadism and masochism, and all, you know, there were people paying to watch these castrations, which surely has to be about sadism, because surely even if you feel that part of your body does not belong to you and doesn't sit right that you have it, that's quite a different thing from wanting to watch other people have parts of their bodies removed, surely. So it does seem like there's sexual sadism rather than disgust being the response for some people. I also found myself thinking that there's something quite, possibly quite histrionic at play here as well, because the idea of, again, I can get my head around somebody, you know, the idea of somebody wanting part of their body missing because they've projected a lot of hate onto it. They hold that part of their body responsible for all their discomfort. But the idea that you would then want to, you know, broadcast that out to the world, that's something different, isn't it?
Well, it is. But again, there's such a wide range of human experience, and the television and films are full, absolutely full of hideous, sadistic portrayals. So this interest is widespread, one might almost say universal. And I think the extra thing that comes into play for some people is a blockage of some kind on their identification with the other. So the pain and distress that the other may be feeling. Because while a lot of this that we're talking about is allegedly consensual, although quite how that can be the case if somebody is seriously disturbed is another matter. But of course, some of it is not consensual. It's performed upon people who certainly don't want to be involved.
Was that a feature of this particular case?
Which one? Sorry.
The idea that some of the people didn't want it to be performed, you know, that they were coerced into it.
Well, when I was speaking, I actually had in mind the case that I worked with at Millfields, Jason Marshall, who was with us because he was a fantasist, and he dressed up as a policeman or sometimes as other adjuncts of the state, and exploited people. But later on, after he left us, he went to Italy, where he engaged a man for sexual favours and murdered him, and attempted to kill another man. And then it was discovered that he'd actually killed a man in Uxbridge in similar circumstances, during which the whole event had been filmed by the chance of the man having his computer turned on with the camera running. So that's how he was ultimately discovered. And clearly there was something in Jason which gained pleasure from the acts of seeing others humiliated, hurt and killed. And there was something operating which stopped him being able to feel that himself. Now, I think some people don't have that capacity.
Well, I was thinking as you were talking about that particular individual, David, that sounds much more to be a kind of like a question around sadism and, you know, pleasure at seeing other people hurt. Whereas I suppose in this case, they're just, you know, these do seem to be people who actually want their own bodies mutilated, which, you know, does seem quite incomprehensible in some way. But there has been some research into the, you know, the neuroscience, and when they've looked at people's brains in body identity dysphoria generally, you know, one theory is the brain hasn't mapped the body correctly, and that the part of the brain that controls how we feel and interpret feedback from the lower limbs has got reduced connection and reduced grey matter. So that's what leads to the desire for the amputation, the acting like the amputee, is that somehow some of those connections in the brain aren't working that tell the person that limb belongs to me. What about the financial motive? Do you think that features in this crime? I mean, Sugiyama made £800 for castrating himself and serving his genitals up for dinner.
It probably looked much more in yen. I think he may have made money in other ways. I mean, I think the mere desire to make money, because I think initially he was going to charge much more, wasn't he, to a smaller group of individuals. But perhaps you're right, perhaps profit wasn't a major incentive for him. But it seems to have been present in the situation involving Gustafsson and others. Their pay-per-view sites, didn't it?
I wondered if there was a kind of like a need for shock with that as well, in terms of, you know, maybe it was about money, but I suppose, again, I think when you think about removing such a vital part of who we are as human beings, £200,000 over a 6-year period doesn't sound, and potentially spread across 9 people, doesn't sound like a vast sum of money, considering the absolutely life-changing surgeries that were happening.
No, it doesn't at all sound like a good return upon investment, really. But presumably they didn't know the total outcome when they did it. So it sounds as if it was that, and exhibitionism was, you know, at least part of a motive.
Yeah, it certainly seems to be some kind of like need to shock, doesn't there? You know, Gustafsson hasn't just had himself castrated, but the fact that he's wished to broadcast that does suggest some drive for attention and some need to shock. And I wondered if you had any thoughts about, you know, that part of people's personalities. You know, we've both worked with people with quite histrionic presentation, where people have gone to quite great lengths to be the centre of attention and to create visibility for their actions. I wondered whether you had any thoughts on that.
Well, Amy, I related to that, I think. I know that you were tweeting fairly recently on whether it was possible to work with people if you didn't like them. And I was thinking, well, that's an interesting question. I wonder how I'm going to respond to this myself, because there have certainly been situations where I felt that that people I was working with were trying to shock me. For example, by telling me of disgusting things they'd done, which were either sexual or to do with mucosal parts of the body.
What does that mean?
It actually meant eating the... I'll just put it, eating some of the substances from their dogs.
Okay. Yeah.
And so I certainly had the feeling that they were trying to evoke a response in me, which would have been akin to shock and disgust. But because the other side of that was that there was something about themselves that they really did want to talk about. In one case, it was about their prurient interest in what other people got up to. And the other case, it was more to do with just getting a response from me.
Yeah,
whether that meant that I didn't like them or not, I certainly had mixed feelings about them.
I think when I think back to people I've worked with where there's been that desire to shock, quite often it's been because as little kids, they felt they got no attention unless they did something that was really shocking. And it was almost like to shock people meant they existed. You know, that actually if you shocked somebody, you got some kind of attention, and that was better than the absolute barrenness that was there within the family home. So actually that desire to shock, you know, also I think comes with quite a lot of sadness that someone would have to debase themselves to that kind of level, and that all they could hope for isn't kind of like warmth or affection, but shock being the only sense of a reminder that they do actually exist in the world. You know, there's something deeply, deeply sad about that, I think.
Yeah, I think that's very well put and explains really why we always find it so important in our work to stick with things, to recognise that all sorts of things will emerge in the relationship that we form with somebody we're working with, and that many of those will be uncomfortable, tell us something about their earliest emotional experiences and how they get, you know, expressed and projected onto us.
Yeah. So in terms of treatment, because there's such little research in this area, people don't really know, I think, what treatment might look like. And certainly it seems as though people have advocated for, certainly in body identity, body integrity dysphoria, there's been people advocating that they should be allowed to have surgery to remove limbs. I'm not sure about whether anyone would be advocating for that in the sense of in the penis. But I did think, maybe it'd be interesting to think about what we might think might, you know, if someone such as this came into our services, what would we have offered as a form of treatment?
Well, we'll know, of course, that whether surgery is offered, some people will harm themselves in any case, and going to the sort of lengths that we've been talking about this morning. So how does one then do the least possible harm, or make the safest kind of intervention? I think it's extremely troubling. I mean, I wouldn't like to be in the position of someone who was having to perform those operations. I think there are probably people out there who would be happy to perform those operations, and I'd be a bit concerned about their motivation.
Yeah, I mean, there have been, you know, people have performed those operations, although don't have the names to hand. I did read about the first doctor that performed that. But I suppose, you know, when you're talking about the penis, there is also, of course, if the motivation is about sexual arousal and a wish to remove, you know, the source, you know, the sense of that they could pose a risk, or they could compromise their own internalized moral values, then I guess there are solutions like anti-libidinal medication or some antidepressants that reduce libido. So you know, I've worked with people who've sought out anti-libidinal medication because they've been so troubled by very unhealthy, sexually deviant desires. But I think when somebody's history of childhood sexual abuse is the cause of their hatred of that part of their body, then actually talking therapies ought to be really successful. And certainly I know of people who have stopped attacking their penis after having successfully engaging in long-term talking therapy, where they've been able to remove the shame, that sense of shame for being sexually abused, so they haven't had to feel like they've got to hold all this shame within themselves. I was also interested, though, to read about, you know, for some people where they've had the body form of this, that they've pretended to be an amputee, and that's actually really helped them. So I guess where people have been fetishizing amputees, or where there might be a wish to have the attention of that a disabled person might have, as far as they see it through their eyes, pretending to be an amputee might solve that. Also, I read about an interesting study where people were using augmented reality to try and address body identity, body integrity dysphoria. And I suppose as well, I imagine that in the future, if the brain is implicated in terms of parts of the brain not having adequate connections, my guess is in the future there will be brain stimulating devices that will be able to assist people. I suppose I just hate somebody to be struggling with feeling as though their penis doesn't belong to them and go to some kind of drastic measure to remove it, when there will, you know, there will be other options and other ways forward. I think, you know, to self-castrate just seems such a drastic step to take.
Yes. I mean, I suspect, as with many things, early intervention is the ideal passage. And like you, I would tend to think of psychological, psychotherapeutic approaches before major surgery is incurred. But we know it can be difficult to engage people. I think we got much better at doing that with the development of the personality disorder pathway project, which kind of insists that we all try harder to engage with apparently challenging clients. I think we've got better really at not giving up, but still it is hard to engage people who don't want to do it, and one's always on the edge of a complex philosophical debate as there is around at the moment, yeah, concerning body identity and conversion therapy and all that, all those businesses. You know, they're hard to talk about in a public discourse.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, there was something else that, as you were talking, that I also wanted to say. Oh, in terms of the personality disorder pathway as well, I think certainly in a prison setting, that the people that end up in those services often do have committed crimes, which are a little bit unusual. And so might also include features like dismemberment or a particular self-hatred, which may be manifest in some physical attack on the body, a bit more unusual than you might find in more mainstream forensic settings. It's been really interesting having this conversation with you, Dave, and mulling things over. You brought to mind actually quite a lot of other relevant culture, or even to kind of like thinking about the history of eunuchs, and the fact that culturally that has, you know, in societies been normal at some point in time. So it's interesting that we're now so shocked and horrified. I had wondered whether disgust had contributed to the lack of kind of like column inches in thinking about, you know, why hadn't come to my attention at the point where they were arrested, for instance. I, you know, only reading about it now as he's about to be sentenced. But I think, you know, when you start looking into these kinds of behaviours, which seem really bizarre and incomprehensible, that actually the more that you start looking into them, the more that you actually see people's distress, and also see that the behaviours are quite often very dysfunctional solutions to really difficult problems that people, intrapsychic problems that people are struggling with.
Yeah, that's very well put. I wonder if the lack of newspaper inches, column inches, it may be linked to the sort of newspapers that you read, Naomi. and
maybe.
Because there seem to be plenty of column inches in the Sun and the Daily Mail for some reason. So I was struck by how, well, of course, it's a truism, isn't it? The range of human experience and human results is massive. It's infinite, really. And it causes, yeah, powerful reactions from disgust, anger, and sympathy on the other end of the spectrum.